Welcome to the Brave Living Podcast, where your story matters. Each life lesson gives us the opportunity to unleash our story and change lives. Listen with your host, Patty Zimke.
Hello and welcome. Today on Brave Living, I'm talking to my friend, Claudia Mercier. Before we get started, I want to let my listeners know that the audio was recorded over a phone, so you're likely going to hear a slight echo. It's just how it was recorded, but the information is so rich, I think you're going to love it anyways. So my friend Claudia is mom to 6 children and is both a foster mom and an adopted mom. She is genuinely one of the kindest souls on the planet. I'm not even kidding. Well, several years ago, Claudia spoke at our church about suffering from postpartum depression. Depression is one of those things that so many of us suffer from, and yet we don't even let others know about it. To the outside world, you can look fine, but on the inside, it can cause you to doubt everything that you know about yourself. Today, we're going to talk to Claudia about her journey through postpartum depression and severe anxiety and discuss how she made it through and what she recommends for others who are going through a similar experience. Hi, Claudia. How are you doing?
Hi, Patty. I'm doing great.
Thank you for doing this. So I briefly introduced you. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure, yeah. So my name is Claudia Mercier, and my husband Mike and I have been married 24 years. We have 6 children. The oldest is 22, then my daughter Emma is 22, my son is 21. We have boy girl twins that are 18. My son Michael is 11, and my son Skylar is 3. Mike and I, we always wanted a big family. Mike is 1 of 8. His dad is 1 of 8. And we ended up having pretty significant fertility issues, which helped us conceive our first 4 children. Part of the reason that we got twins.
Okay.
And then when the twins were babies, we wanted more children. We wanted a big family. That was something that we had discussed and we were really both on board for. So we tried to do more fertility treatment and it wasn't successful.
So that's when you got into fostering, right?
Right, exactly. That's when we thought, well, maybe we're meant to grow our family a different way. And we really felt the Lord leading us to be foster parents. So we did that. We went through the licensing process and got fully licensed and had a sibling set come stay with us, our first children, sibling set in January 2006. Mm-hmm. And they stayed with us for 8 months, and it was a great experience. It was a lot of work, but it was a great experience. When they left us, I was really tired and a little bit confused about why I was so tired. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that I was pregnant with our 5th child. So
wow.
That was a huge surprise. No fertility treatment, just out
happened.
Of the blue. And you hear that a lot. You know, people, as soon as people stop trying, then boom, they end up pregnant.
Right,
and so that,
right.
And so that was a real amazing, wonderful surprise for us. We were thrilled.
I bet. So your son was born, and was it after that that you started experiencing symptoms?
So, yeah. So that child, Michael, was born in May of 2007, and we were literally over the moon. I mean, like I said, we wanted a big family. This was such an unexpected blessing for us. And for him to just come to us like that was just incredible. So we were thrilled. And he was born in May. And it was about 1 month later that I started noticing that I wasn't my usual very upbeat, perky person. I wasn't like that anymore. And after a while, I couldn't find joy in anything. And nothing seemed fun anymore. So I do remember about a month postpartum, we went on a big family vacation to Mexico. And I have very vivid memories of basically crying in the hotel room almost the whole vacation. My husband was off playing with the big kids, and
right.
So I was left in the hotel room by my, you know, desire. I mean, I wanted to be with my baby, but I would be in the hotel room largely tending to the baby, but mostly crying, and it was a very unhappy vacation. By the time I got home from Mexico, it just intensified. I started feeling really alone, really unworthy. Pretty soon I started crying. I was crying, you know, almost every day, almost the whole day.
Wow. You were a social worker, so you had seen people who have gone through depression. Did you realize you were in a depression, or was it?
You know, that's the crazy thing is that I am a clinical social worker by training and by profession, and even in the midst of it, I didn't even fully know what was going on. I mean, I really felt like I was just falling into an abyss.
Yeah.
And not really realizing what was happening. I don't think I really was able to say, oh, this is baby blues or this is postpartum depression. depression.
Right.
I just was falling. And then I have a very vivid memory of the first panic attack. Mm. And that was, oh my gosh, what's happening to me? Like something terrible. I remember saying to my husband, I don't know what's happening, but something is happening. Something terrible is happening. And so I had no awareness at that moment that, oh, this is a panic attack. You're having a panic. I've never had one before.
Right.
So I was just blindsided.
What does it feel like? I've not had a panic attack either. But what does it feel like?
I think it's very difficult to understand a panic attack unless you've experienced it, because it is the most terrifying thing. The best way to describe it is you're absolutely convinced that death is imminent.
Wow.
Absolutely convinced. And this propelled me on multiple occasions to the emergency room, and I had to go to the emergency room because I was about to die. So we quickly figured out that if I set foot in the emergency room, it cost $2,000.
Right.
So I had to learn how to not go to the emergency room every time I had a panic attack. I would say the first 4 to 6 months of all of this, it felt like I was just falling down a hole of depression, falling down a hole of anxiety, panic, and swirling and not knowing what was going on.
Did anyone in your circle, like your family or close friends, did they notice something? Did they say something to you?
Well, it was basically my husband, of course, because he lived with me, and my mom.
Okay.
And so I tried very hard. I didn't want to too much let on to the kids to scare them. And so I think that I really tried very hard to put on a happy face for the kids, as hard as that was.
Yeah.
But I tell you that to the population at large, no, I was the master of disguise. I really, it was a very quiet, personal journey that I took, not letting on to the world. And I thought that through before. Why was it that I didn't let people in? Why was it that I didn't, that I was the master of disguise? And I think it's because, A, I didn't want to burden anybody. It's massive. You see somebody in the hallway at church or in the shopping center and they say, hey, how are you?
Right.
And you don't want to say, well, actually, in the midst of the worst depression and anxiety of my life, and they're going to be standing there going, okay.
Yeah.
Right. And the second thing is, it's very hard to be that vulnerable with people, especially in casual conversations. So,
absolutely.
I got very, very good at hiding it. There were a few moments that I do remember. I was so affected that try as I might, I couldn't. And there were some friends in the hallway at church that saw me, and the tears just overflowed my eyes, and they were, gravely concerned. Oh my goodness, what's going on? And then I just kind of excused myself and left. And one friend in particular called me that afternoon and said, "What?" She was so concerned.
Mm.
But by and large, I was very good at hiding it. So almost nobody knew.
So how did you start the process of getting help? Did you reach a low point? Was there the darkest hour?
I fought getting help for a very, very long time. In my mind, help was medication.
Okay.
And for some reason, that had a stigma in my mind associated with it. I was very convinced that it would run its course, that it would get better on its own, or that I could figure it out.
Yeah.
So I really fought getting help. I didn't want to go see a doctor. I didn't want to get on medication. But it got to the point where I was so impaired that I could barely function. I had children to take care of. I had a house to run, and I couldn't do anything. So it became not my decision anymore. I recognized that for the sake of my family, for the sake of my husband and my kids, I had to go get help. So I did see a couple doctors that I felt were very unsympathetic and just wanted to give me a prescription and not send me on my way.
Yes.
So I got a little discouraged early on, but by God's divine design and mercy, I suddenly landed. A friend knew a doctor who was just lovely, and I got backdoored into his office, which was absolutely amazing, and there's no other way to describe it, but thank God intervened there and created that situation for me to get into that doctor. And he was so wonderful. He had a full practice that squeezed me in, super compassionate and sensitive, and started me on some medication.
Yeah.
The first two medications I think that I tried, I had some side effects that didn't work for me, but we persevered. And by the time I got on the third medication, and it was even the right medication at the wrong dose didn't help.
Yeah.
But the right medication at the right dose, it was ridiculous. 30 milligrams did nothing. 45 milligrams was the magic number.
Right.
So think that was the beginning of my recovery. It was absolutely the beginning of my recovery. I won't go on record as saying I got on medication and that was the end of the story.
No.
I was better.
Right.
But it was the beginning. It got me up enough. It got my head enough above water to be able to say, okay, what else can I do?
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
What else can I do to augment my recovery?
Exactly. I suffer from depression also. And when I've been really depressed, it's like, it is like a fog and I just want to sleep. And everyday activities just seem like even taking a shower is just, it's such work. And I can't imagine with five kids how much that must have been for you.
Yeah, exactly. It was a challenge. And you know, my mom was really great. She helped out a lot. And I do think that my busy life actually was kind of helpful for me because I really couldn't wallow in the bed too long. I mean, there were things that I still had to do. It was at least the minimal stuff that I had to do.
Yeah.
So I think that had I not had that pressure that forced me to stay in life a bit.
Yeah.
And so that ended up being helpful because I think my natural tendency would have been to opt out of everything.
Right.
And I think that fuels it. And even when I started coming up for air more and I would still have some down days, I started learning, force yourself to do it. Force yourself to go out on that outing with the family. Force yourself to go to lunch.
Yeah.
Force yourself. And more often than not, making myself do the activity, it helped.
Yeah.
I felt better. I felt better by getting myself dressed and going out to lunch or, you know, doing what I had to do. And so I do think there's some level of fighting against it where you, even though you don't feel like it, even though you don't want to, even though it's not work, you make the effort, do it anyway, because otherwise you isolate yourself so much and it escalates the depression.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It does. When I was at UCLA, that's when I was super depressed. And I remember just forcing myself to get up and walk around because it would make me feel better. So what would you say was your darkest point?
My darkest point was probably was before the medication began, and I was just spiraling really low, and I started not having suicidal thoughts, but getting very, feeling like they were the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, feeling like suicidal thoughts were the next thing, and that really terrified me.
Sure.
And the other thing that has really stuck with me in my journey through depression is how profoundly depression alters one's perspective.
Mm.
And it's so sinister. I think it really causes you to believe things that are absolutely not true. I became very, very convinced that I remember these were my key core beliefs in the worst part of the depression. My husband doesn't love me.
Ugh.
My husband would be better off without me. And I have no friends at all. None.
Oh, wow.
And I was absolutely convinced of all of those things. And the reality was, if you were an outsider looking at my life, you would have concluded that there was 0% truth to any of those statements.
Oh, absolutely.
But it didn't matter. And it later on, when the depression lifted and I was able to look back, I thought, that is really the most dangerous part about depression.
Yeah.
Is how profoundly it lies to you. Can shed a little bit of light on why people resort to some extreme measures, because in that moment, you're so deeply convinced of these very scary beliefs that are in your head. But here's the interesting thing for me. I had a very profound encounter with God right about that time. Like when I was really bogged down in all these feelings of you are alone, nobody loves you, you don't have friends, your husband would be better off without you. I really felt, I had a very profound encounter with him where I felt like he said to me, can you do this for me? Can you just put those aside for 1 minute and verbalize to me what you absolutely know to be true about me? What do you absolutely know to be true about me?
Wow.
And I was very impaired at that time, and so I wasn't super eloquent, but I thought, well, I remember when my new baby, this baby was born, I was sitting in the nursery with him, and I remember blown away by God's grace in that moment. Here I've been trying for infertility for years, all these drugs, no baby, and then, you know, boom, the Lord hands me this beautiful, perfect newborn baby.
Yeah.
And I remember in the nursery saying, I will never again doubt that you are good. Yeah. I remembered saying that. And so in that moment when I was plagued by all these, you know, deceptive thoughts, I said out loud, Lord, I absolutely know you are good. And then I said, I know you are faithful because your word tells me so. And then he said, cling to those things like a lifeboat. Just cling to those two truths. And so the next day, when I would feel you have no friends, nobody loves you, I would say, the Lord is good and he is faithful. God is good and he is faithful. And I really did. I clinged to those like a lifeboat.
Yeah.
On my very worst days, it became my mantra. And it was interesting that right on the heels of that, I was led to this wonderful doctor. And right after that, was led to other things that really empowered me to fight the depression and begin to turn it around. It was a powerful moment in my life. You know, there's few, you can look back in your life and there's few moments where you said, I feel like I really encountered God in that moment. And, and my darkest place was where I encountered him.
Oh, that's so beautiful. God was there for you and just comforted you when you really, oh, that's just such a beautiful story.
Well, and it was such a piece of grace in that moment because it was such a counterpoint to, you know, the lies that I had was really starting to believe, and I needed a counterpoint to those lies. I needed to say, I'm not listening to that. I'm listening to this. I'm choosing to cling to this instead of to that.
That's so good.
And it was significant. It was significant, and it was just significant to become, for it to be my mantra day in and day out, to be meditating on it. And I think it created it just a full dependence on God. Like, Lord, I am at my very lowest place, but in the deepest part of the pit, I'm going to choose to look to you and to cling to you.
Yeah.
And he was really faithful to continue to show me more and more about what I could do to battle the depression.
Yeah. Oh, that's just so good. So what would you say to someone who's going through this or feels like they're not themselves anymore?
I think that one of the hardest things, I think, when you're in the midst of it, is the feeling that you have no power over this, that the depression has just pulled you into this pit, or the anxiety or the panic attacks are coming at you fast and furious, and that you're just being pummeled and you're really completely out of power in this situation. And what I want to say is you actually have so much power. There really is so much that you can do as impaired as you are, for any level of impairment.
Yeah.
You know, if you're so impaired that you can barely get out of bed, are you willing to try a trial of medication? Can we just get you to go to a doctor, get a prescription, and try something? And if that one doesn't work, to try another.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you hit the right one, it can be life-changing.
Absolutely.
You know, the other thing is a light therapy device, for example, is very powerful, especially in the winter months.
Yes.
So if you're, for the life of you, can't imagine getting on medication, are you willing to try sitting with a light therapy device for a few 20 or 30 minutes each morning?
Right.
Another one is I have become an absolute firm believer in the power of changing your diet. You absolutely can eat for mental health stability.
Mm.
There is so much correlation between how you eat and how you feel. It's astounding.
Yeah.
And making some small changes to your diet, little by little, changes that build on each other is incredibly powerful. And I have learned of a food plan that I ended up adopting that was probably, the next to the medication, the single most significant part of my recovery. There's also things like exercise, getting outside in the sunshine, specific supplements. I mean, there's a menu of things that people can try. And I think that everybody's recipe for wellness is a little bit different. So my recipe included medication in this food plan and getting out more. Other people's recipe might look a little bit different. It might have more to do with more exercise or getting out with friends more. But there's, you know, I think there's 8 or 10 components in there. And so it's like a menu, and you need to try and see what your wellness recipe. And that's that collectively healed me.
Yeah.
So it wasn't any one thing specifically that healed me. But I've walked with several friends now through very profound depressions, and we've been able to just go, what of all these things feels palatable? What can you start with? And they start with one, and they start noticing that there is so much to be done. And knowledge is power, really. Knowledge is power. The more you know about depression and the more you know what contributes to it, the more you can create what I call an antidepressant lifestyle, which I think is very in stark contrast to kind of the traditional Western lifestyle, you know. So much of what is antidepressant is getting out, getting exercise, being in the sunshine, being with friends, eating well. You know, in American modern life, a lot of us are isolated indoors all the time, eating highly processed foods, you know.
Yes.
So it is. It's moving away from those things that contribute to depression, moving away from that into those things that depression can't get a stronghold. When you're embracing those things, depression doesn't really have a place to get a stronghold.
Oh, that's such good advice. When you think about it, that's kind of what God has given us, right? We've man-made processed stuff and all of that. But go back to what God gave us, nature and what comes from nature. And it's our own healing. He made it for us.
Yeah. And I think I read this great book that he talked about. If you look at the populations in the world where the incidence of depression is almost non-existent, you know, and you would be surprised. It's like the Amish and the hunter-gatherer tribes, you know, in the bushland.
Wow.
And you look at their lifestyles and you go, well, why is there no depression there? But it's because they're in community all the time. They're working together.
Yeah.
They're outside in the sunshine getting, you know, all those great sunshine, vitamin D and everything. And they're getting exercise.
Yeah.
And they're engaged in meaningful activity, you know, and their diets are a far cry from the highly processed, white, sugar-laden diet that we have. It's an epidemic here.
That's so true.
I think a lot of eating for mood stability is eating for blood sugar stability.
Yeah.
I think we can eat in such a way that our blood sugar stays largely stable throughout the day. That helps your mood stay more stable. And so when people are skipping meals, particularly breakfast, you've had an all-night fast.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people skip breakfast and then your blood sugar crashes. And it's setting you up for kind of, you know, a mood upheaval all day long. So things like sugar, white carbs, they tend to spike your blood sugar a lot. And so what you really want to do is move toward a food plan where you're balancing your blood sugar more and you're eating quite soon after getting up and you're eating more complex carbs, a healthy fat, and protein. A lot of the building blocks in protein are what help your brain make the important chemicals for mood stability. So, trying to minimize white foods, white sugar, and boosting your protein is going to go a long way toward making you feel more even and not kind of rocked with the volatility of your blood sugar through the day.
Yeah, that's really great advice, Claudia. What about friends? Because when you're depressed, at least for me, I wouldn't reach out to anybody. Like, I felt like I was in a fog. Like, what can we as friends do? How can we be better?
I think that friends do have the obstacle in that a lot of times people won't let on to you. You know, you might suspect that somebody's having a hard time, but they haven't really come out and said it because they're being the master of disguise. And so they haven't really let people into that private struggle.
Yeah.
I think that if you suspect that a friend is depressed, I think there's nothing like calling them up and setting a time to come and get together with them. Don't leave the ball in their court because they're never going to call you.
Right.
I think it would just being a little bit deliberate about saying, I want to come over and I want to, you know, take you to lunch or let's meet for coffee and really have something very specific on the agenda.
Uh-huh.
If the person is homebound and they're not even going out, let them know that you're coming over at a certain time. My favorite thing is if you can get them to go on a walk with you. Can I come over and we walk for 30 minutes?
Yeah.
Because now you've got the triple whammy of social contact, exercise, and fresh air and sunshine.
Yeah.
I think that what you hope to illustrate to them is by the time you circle back from your walk, they're feeling a bit better. It felt better. They liked it.
Right.
So reaching out to them for sure and being very specific about spending time with them.
Yeah.
And you know, taking it upon yourself to make sure that it gets set.
Right.
Set up. And you're let into that inner world, you know, to just listen, be an ear for them and help them to just know that there's somebody else in the journey with them, I think.
Yeah, that's great. Because that can help when depression's lying to you, telling you these lies, it can counteract that too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's hard to it's hard to hold truth to the lies that depression is telling you. For example, nobody loves you, you have no friends, and then there's a friend knocking at your door saying, I'm here, I care.
That's right.
And so then they have to reconcile that in their head. Well, wait a minute, so-and-so just came over.
Right.
So how can both be true? And it really is a lesson in, just because I think it doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah.
You know, that became a catchphrase for me, just because I think something doesn't mean it's true.
Oh, that's so good.
And helping them maybe to evaluate some of the thoughts that they're having and say, okay, what are your pervasive thoughts? And let's look at that, and let's look at it critically and say, you know, do we think there's truth to that? Or maybe that's something that's the depression talking. And for myself and for my friends, once the depression lifted, we didn't believe those things anymore.
Right.
You know, it was really an example of the depression, it has its own voice. It takes on its own voice. And when the depression lifts, you don't believe those things anymore. So
great. Thank you so much, Claudia. Is there anything else that you would like to add that you think is important?
You know, I think it's one thing that I did want to throw in is really important, in particular with anxiety and panic attacks, and just going back to how much power we have in these things. I think one of the most helpful things with anxiety and panic in general was when I learned about the concept of first fear and second fear. So, for example, we'll take the example of you just launched a child off to college. Your daughter's just launched off to college. It's, you know, week two of freshman.
Mm-hmm.
And you're texting her, and she's not texting you back. Maybe half a day goes by, you haven't received a text back from her. The first fear is, oh, my child hasn't texted me back. That's the first fear.
Mm-hmm.
What we do with that next kind of determines the trajectory of where anxiety goes. We can say to ourselves, well, I'm sure she's in class, or she's really busy, or her phone is, you know, she hasn't charged her phone, or she's having a great time with all her new friends. She'll get back to me later.
Mm-hmm.
And telling myself that has the result of decreasing my anxiety. Okay, all right, that's normal. You know,
right.
College kids don't have to always text their mom back right away. But what I used to do is, oh my gosh, something really must be the matter. I wonder if she's okay. She might not be okay. I wonder if she's in a bad situation. And then I can really send myself into anxiety, which then sends me into panic. And I got to be very, very good at that. I got to be an expert at taking somewhat of an innocuous first fear and spiraling it into actually a panic attack, where I became completely panicked that my child had been kidnapped or something dreadful had happened to her. And it's a skill that you can become very good at, is catching yourself in that moment where you have something that, and you have a choice which way to go with it. You have a choice to calm yourself down,
mm-hmm.
or you have a choice to escalate your anxiety. And in this way, I started learning how I was actually participating in the escalation of my anxiety. As I realized that, I could become very good at de-escalating my anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's not something that you can learn. You don't learn it overnight. It's not automatic, but you become aware of that you're doing it. And when you become aware of it, you stop yourself and you start talking yourself down and saying, what's the most reasonable scenario here? The most reasonable scenario is she's busy.
Right.
The most reasonable scenario is not she's kidnapped.
Right.
So anyway, and that just speaks more to getting empowered, knowing that you have control, knowing you have control there. Yes, there are things you can do to battle your depression. And yes, you can learn to de-escalate your anxiety so that it doesn't well up into panic.
Yeah. Oh, that speaks so much to me, because I do that. I definitely do that. And that's just wise advice. Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and we're moms, and so we worry. And then the news stories don't help with those things. So I think we have to decide that we're not going to panic.
Yeah.
Let's decide to not panic about things that have a less than 1% of chance of happening in this life. We do have to be reasonable and say, let's not panic when it's the most extreme unlikely scenarios. Let's not participate in the escalation of it.
Right. Oh, that's really good. Well, Claudia, thank you so much for talking to me. I think so many people will benefit from just hearing your story and knowing that they aren't alone, that a lot of people suffer this, and that depression lying to you is just so powerful. And just doing small things, that's just great advice.
Well, and I think the more that I've started to share my story, the more other people, I've learned that so many people have walked this journey. And we're all kind of quietly walking it. You know, people are just quietly struggling with this depression. And I walk through the world differently now. I don't walk through the world thinking, everybody's got it all together and that person looks great. And, right. you know, I now walk around and go, what private struggle is that person going through? I sit in the back of church and I look out at the sea and I think everybody here looks, they all look great. They all look fine.
Right.
But now I know better. You know, we're not all great. We're not all fine. It's astonishing to me how many people have come up and say, me too. Me too. I've walked that journey too. And it's scary. I mean, it does seem to be quite an epidemic at this time. So,
yeah, it does.
You know, the you are alone, nobody else feels this way is absolutely a lie.
Yes, it is. Oh, that's so good. All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for my listeners for listening. And until next time, live brave and enjoy your day.